Afterwards, Brett removed his shirt to reveal that he had been wearing a steel plate. "Hey, Bischoff," he growled into the house mic. "I quit." And he stormed off. "When I got home," Brett said, "I actually contemplated quitting for real. It seemed to me that Eric just didn't have enough wrestling smarts to do his job." Regardless of the ridiculous notion that Brett would come to Nitro with a steel plate under his jersey so he could knock out Goldberg, some people in the company actually thought this was real. Part of that had to do with a loud argument between Brett and Eric backstage right after the segment, with no cameras present. Most everyone in the company, however, knew it for what it really was, another lame attempt to work the boys. Brett disappeared from TV for a while, in part because he had to undergo groin surgery that would keep him on the shelf for several months. Ultimately, nothing became of the angle, but for once, Brett's absence wasn't WCW's fault, and this time, the reasons behind it were devastatingly tragic. On May 23, 1999, Bret Hart's brother Owen died. While any wrestling death is tragic, this one was different. Owen didn't die due to a heart problem, likely brought on by excessive steroid abuse. He didn't overdose on the popular combination of alcohol and pain pills. He didn't die by any fault of his own. Owen James Hart died because he was a company man, a pawn in a ratings battle that had already been over for a long time. The scene was the WWF's Over the Edge pay-per-view from the Kemper Arena in Kansas City. The time was approximately 7:40 p.m. Central. Owen stood high in the rafters above the ring, dressed up in a ridiculous blue superhero costume, and hooked up to a harness. Early in his career, he had wrestled as the Blue Blazer, a masked, high-flying good guy. This was 1999, however, and masked, high-flying good guys were not cool. Instead, they were comedy material. Owen, back in character, told children to drink their milk, and because guys who told children to drink their milk weren't cool anymore, he was a bad guy. He was, essentially, a spoof on the babyface Hulk Hogan, and his descent from the rafters was a spoof on the babyface Sting. The plan was for him to descend to the ring for his entrance, and then get, quote, stuck about 10 feet above the canvas and do a pratfall once released. For days, Hart had been nervous about this stunt, but, as a model employee, the closest he ever came to refusing was when he told them he wouldn't do a second practice run-through on the day of the show. Obviously, a pratfall from above the ring would require a quick release mechanism. Those who watched Sting's previous descents will probably recall how long it took him to get his harness off once he reached the ground. He had to unhook the main harness, then the safety backup. Neither had a quick release mechanism. Tragically, the harness Owen was attached to on this evening was not designed to hold the weight of a 220-pound man. It was actually used on sailboats. As a video of him cutting a promo aired on the Titantron, the harness released prematurely, and he fell 71 feet into the ring. The physicians on hand attended to him. Then he was rushed to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Moments after his body was taken through the curtain, and a moment still debated to this day, Vince McMahon made the decision to continue the show. Nobody involved, from the wrestlers to the announcers to the employees backstage to the fans, can likely remember very clearly much of what happened in the next 2 hours. The next day's Raw was a strange show, seen as an example of damage control by some and as a beautiful tribute by others. They presented several straight-up wrestling matches with clean finishes, and in between, interviews with the wrestlers. Many of the wrestlers openly broke down and wept when talking about Owen. Nitro opened with a graphic and a three-bell salute. Then Tony Schiavone offered his condolences to the family. Hours after the accident occurred, Bischoff met Brett at the airport and chartered him a flight back to Calgary. He told him that he didn't expect him to come to Nitro at any point in the future and that he could take as much time off as needed to get through this. Brett strongly considered retirement, feeling he'd never get his passion for the business back, and it would be virtually impossible to ever feign anger towards someone for a wrestling storyline again. Obviously, all plans to do a Brett vs. Goldberg program were shelved indefinitely. Owen's death wasn't the only tragedy to hit the Hart family around this time. On April 5th, Brett's brother-in-law, Davey Boy Smith, lay at the ICU at Calgary's Rocky View Hospital, being fed through an IV. It had been a rough few years for him. First, he suffered multiple knee injuries at the end of his WWF run in 1997. Then he was so upset with what happened in Montreal that he requested his release from the company. Vince McMahon, generous soul that he is, said sure, but it would cost Smith $150,000 to get out of his contract. Smith paid up after he negotiated this down to $100,000. Things didn't end up any better in WCW, as he took a body slam during a match with Alex Wright at Fall Brawl and landed right on top of the trap door that was used to help Warrior magically appear and disappear. He crushed the C9 and C10 vertebrae in his back and fractured four other vertebrae. To mask the pain, he was taking a laundry list of pain medication, including morphine, and when he finally checked into rehab after his wife, Diana, tried to scare him straight by overdosing on 100 Xanax, not the ideal way to try to scare someone straight, he took 3 weeks to detox instead of the usual 5 days. Top of all that, he was suffering from a staph infection and was confined to a full body cast. At the time, many speculated that his career was over, and he was in bad enough shape that there was some fear he might not survive. WCW, obviously deeply concerned, cited the 90-day injury clause in his contract and immediately fired him via their usual delivery method, FedEx. This caused such an uproar that Bischoff immediately went on the defensive, saying he had no idea what rough shape Smith was in when he made the decision. And for a period of time at least, Davey Boy's checks kept coming. In late April, the Spanish-language Telemundo opted to pick up Nitro for another 6 months, which was a shock to everyone. After the WCW Latino deal fell through, WCW started sending one-hour edited versions of Nitro to the station. Pretty much everyone thought the deal would go bust since the Mexicans in WCW were always promoted as total losers. Surprisingly, however, the ratings were really good. One would think that WCW would have seen the success of the show in the Hispanic community and decide to make their Mexican wrestlers look better on TV to help draw new fans. But that never happened, and later in the year, it would be far, far worse. Nitro the following week was notable only for a weird snafu in the main event. It was Hogan versus Flair versus Goldberg versus Page in a four-way for the WCW title. Goldberg hit Hogan with the spear and jackhammer. Nash, Hogan's good buddy, was supposed to make the save. Since Continental Drift is faster than Kevin Nash on foot, he didn't make it to the ring in time. Lo and behold, this caused Hogan to have to kick out of Goldberg's finisher. It was a small thing, but all the small things week after week were starting to seriously water down Goldberg. And that was a common theme. Although Goldberg was a top draw, things were starting to collapse for him. In addition to the loss of the feud with Hart, each week it seemed that events, either planned or unplanned, were watering him down. Goldberg's descent continued at the Spring Stampede pay-per-view, where he wasn't even booked in the main event that saw Dallas Page pin Ric Flair in a four-way, also featuring Sting and Hulk Hogan, to win the WCW World title for the first time in his career. Page was in his mid-40s, but he looked older thanks to years and years of hanging and banging at the beach. From an athletic standpoint, it was no big deal to put the belt on him, because he was a hard worker and he usually had very good matches. The problem was that WCW, over the last 2 years, had gained a reputation of being an old man's company, and taking the belt off a 50-year-old and putting it on a guy who looked 50 did nothing to counter that stereotype. It didn't help that the match was such a mess that most fans didn't even know what happened at the finish. As a result, the crowd reaction to the title change, which would have been disappointing in any case given that Page was the least popular of all the guys in the ring, was even less extraordinary. Perhaps the biggest news coming out of the match was Hogan's fake knee injury. Well, his knee really was hurt, and he did have it scoped a few weeks later, but he didn't get hurt in the match, and they overplayed the severity of the injury. Hogan sold it to the point that he even used help to get into the hotel that night during a period where there weren't any fans around to see it. Most knew what was going on here. He realized he was getting stale on top, plus he saw WCW falling apart at the seams and didn't want to be seen as the guy on top during that period. It didn't matter where Hogan was during this period, he was always working. For instance, he appeared on The Tonight Show on April 9th, the same Tonight Show where he announced his retirement several months earlier. He explained that he never said he was going to retire. He just said that he was tired. Following the airing of an ESPN Outside the Lines special that touched on steroid and human growth hormone use in pro wrestling, WCW scheduled a surprise drug test before the April 15th Thunder. Strangely, Scott Steiner no-showed the event, claiming he had suffered a back injury and was therefore not tested. Not only had Steiner become so muscular he could barely move, but he had also developed a short temper, seemingly flying into an uncontrollable rage at the slightest provocation, to the point that he had been arrested several times. In a match the following week on Nitro, his back seemingly miraculously healed in less than a week, he carried the near 400-pound Scott Norton all the way across the ring before giving him an atomic drop. The crowd, oddly, chanted steroids during the match. Bobby Heenan responded by shouting, "I've never heard a crowd so pumped up before." While Nitro's ratings had unquestionably begun a downturn, other WCW shows were in a flat-out freefall. Longtime WCW fans are probably wondering why little mention has been made so far of the company's other television programs, Thunder and WCW Saturday Night. The main reason is that we decided to give the shows as much attention as WCW gave them, which, as you can see, was essentially zero. Thunder was considered an A show for a week or two, and from that point on, it was just 2 hours of mostly filler. WCW Saturday Night made Thunder look like Raw at its peak. When you have a wrestling show and you treat it as filler, fans quickly stop tuning in. By this point in the war, Thunder, which had been drawing ratings in the fours just a few months earlier, was down to a 2.0, and Saturday Night was down to a 1.7. The Thunder rating was especially bad since advertisers had been sold on the show doing a 3.5. Since the show was promised to do a 3.5, and it did a 2.0, WCW had to recoup advertisers with make-good ads. This costs money. Thunder was consistently so horrible, most weeks the only entertainment the show provided was unintentional comedy and 2 hours worth of bickering between announcers Mike Tenay and Tony Schiavone, who hated each other. It almost seemed as if WCW didn't want the show to get to the 3.5 range, so they were willingly losing money and providing horrible programming week after week. This was not a formula for profit. And now Nitro had begun its ratings collapse as well. The April 19 Nitro illustrated just how bad things had become. Quality-wise, Nitro kicked Raw's ass, but it didn't matter, because as they say in the stock market, Nitro was on a downward trend. They did finally put some effort back into the unopposed hour, including an awesome cruiserweight match and a great interview in which Flair appeared to go insane, but it didn't matter. The damage of all those horrible shows, specifically in the first hour, was done. Overall, Raw did a 6.11 to Nitro's 4.08 that week. The tragically bad shows weren't about to stop either, as confusing, convoluted storylines were now becoming the order of the day. The Crazy Flair interview, in which he stripped down to his boxers, featured the man who was once WCW's top draw, ranting and raving about how he was not only World Heavyweight Champion, but also President of WCW and President of the United States as well. This led to Roddy Piper managing to convince a mental institution to lock Flair up as a madman upon his son David's request. It should also be noted that 3 days later on Thunder, it was announced that Flair had been released and was president of WCW again. Then, 4 days after that on Nitro, the show opened with footage of Flair still locked up. On the bright side, nobody ever watched Thunder, so that storyline snafu could be ignored. While Flair quite literally danced around the hospital in his underwear with other insane inmates, J.J. Dillon announced that since he was vice president of the company, which was news to viewers, Charles Robinson would be the new acting president until Flair returned. For those who don't know the name Charles Robinson, he was a referee whose sole claim to power in WCW was apparently that he was a big Ric Flair fan who had bleached his hair blonde like the Nature Boy. Piper then did an interview saying that since Flair was gone, he was in charge. Although the storyline was not likely designed this way on purpose, it drew close parallels with the real-life WCW, and that nobody really had any clue who was in charge. And if someone said they were in power for the day, everybody just sort of went along with it, because they'd given up long ago. Piper and Robinson then had an in-ring confrontation that ended in Piper being arrested. This ultimately led to Flair versus Piper being signed for the pay-per-view, the stipulation being that if Piper won, he would become WCW president. Perhaps you'll recall that when Flair won the presidency in the match with Bischoff, the stipulation was that he would be the president for life. There is no such thing as for life in wrestling. Flair then ran into Scott Hall, who, as you might recall, had been off TV for some time. It was never explained why Hall was in the mental hospital, and his appearance was never acknowledged by the announcers. Apparently, someone just thought it would be funny to put him in there for a cameo, not understanding that when wrestling fans see something happening on TV, they automatically, and often foolishly, especially in WCW's case, assume that there is a reason behind its occurrence. It wasn't until the following week, in Charlotte, North Carolina, that Flair returned to TV. He explained that Arn Anderson had bailed him out. Bet you never knew that when you're confined to a mental institution, you can leave simply by posting bail. His first order of business was to put a bounty on Kevin Nash's head. Over the course of just this one show, the dollar figure changed from $100,000 to $50,000 to $1 million, depending upon who was telling the story. His second order of business, since it was Charlotte, was to get knocked out by DDP in the main event. If you thought the last three paragraphs were confusing, imagine watching it play out in all of its glory on your television set. And this was just your average convoluted Nitro storyline from 1998 and 1999. This is not to say that the WWF writing on TV was great. Many times a Raw show would draw a tremendous number, and folks would sit there wondering how this was even possible. The WWF writing was full of plot holes and angles that made no sense, angles that often insulted the intelligence of the average human being. But the big difference was simply that WWF's writing was better than WCW's. World Championship Wrestling set a standard for bad television in the late 1990s that will likely never be equaled, and TNA Impact Wrestling in the 2000s tried. There have been countless other bad wrestling TV shows, but they were all bad for other reasons. Perhaps they had no real talent, like GLOW, or bad production, like your typical independent promotion. Or the people writing it did so just to get a family member over as a star. TNA Impact Wrestling. Though to be honest, most every promotion has been guilty of this. WCW was different from all the others. They had a deeper talent pool than any other promotion in the history of this business, and Turner owned them, so they certainly had the capacity for tremendous production. The greatest difference of all, though, was what they did with their talent. While some companies tried way too hard to get a family member over as a star, those companies were at least trying to get someone over as a star. WCW killed all their talent. They killed the undercard guys by making them out to be bit players. They killed the Mid-Carters by making it very clear that they were Mid-Carters for life. And they killed anyone even close to the top of the pack by booking them as goofs or losers or having them alternate between heel and babyface with such rapidity that fans had no idea whether to boo or cheer them. As it turned out, nobody was a star, and worse, when it appeared a wrestler was starting to get some fan support, he was immediately booked into oblivion. And it wasn't just in-ring talent. From a production standpoint, despite having the ability and finances to produce great shows, they had more snafus than one could imagine. Sometimes, when watching Nitro, and especially Thunder, one couldn't help but feel like they were trying to screw things up, because it would take a great deal of talent to purposely make a show seem so unintentionally funny. What is most mind-boggling about WCW TV in 1999, however, was that fans who took copious amounts of aspirin to allow themselves to continue watching week after week could never have imagined that just 1 year later, WCW would get to the point where these storylines looked like Emmy material in comparison. If it wasn't apparent to everyone by this point that the company was in severe trouble, the Charlotte show offered proof positive. The fact that the show was massacred by Raw in the ratings battle by over 3 points was one thing. More damning, however, might have been the fact that despite always drawing big crowds in the Carolinas, they had to give out thousands of free tickets just to get a respectable crowd into the building for TV. WCW had no one but themselves to blame for that. Over the years, they had booked Flair, a hometown hero in the region, so badly that it had become a running joke that whenever they were about to run a show there, something stupid was inevitably going to happen with him. Obviously, having Flair go crazy in a mental institution in a period when heels were supposed to be young and cool was stupid. As entertaining as Flair was, even in roles as idiotic as this, his drawing power was killed in a matter of weeks. This was especially distressing, since he and Goldberg were the only two guys in the entire company who had been able to affect the ratings in any way. Well, in any positive way, at least. Thanks in the storyline to Roddy Piper, Randy Savage finally returned to the promotion. And, like Scott Steiner, he came back so muscular it looked as though he'd been pumped full of air at a service station. He brought with him a new girlfriend, Stephanie Bellers, a young blonde stripper who had been dubbed Gorgeous George. The backstory there is that Rob Kellum, an undercard worker known as the Maestro, had purchased the rights to the name from the family of George Wagner, who had used it during his run as the biggest star of the early days of televised wrestling. Then, WCW bought the rights when they signed Savage's brother, Lanny Poffo, formerly the Genius in the WWF, who was planning on going as Gorgeous George. It would turn out, however, that Poffo would never once appear on WCW TV, so they gave the moniker to Bellers instead. It should be noted that despite his never wrestling a single match for the company, WCW saw fit to pay Lanny Poffo $150,000 per year. At this point, the company decided that perhaps they could slow the ratings slide by playing hot potato with their belts. The April 26th Nitro featured no less than 3 title changes. First, Sting beat Page in an awesome match to win the WCW title. And then, an hour later, Page won it back in a 4-way also featuring Nash and Goldberg, after hitting Nash with an international, called as such because Turner officials wouldn't allow the word foreign object. The latter was, well, not as good as the former. Also, Mysterio beat Psicosis to regain the Cruiserweight belt that he lost a week earlier. This was the beginning of the desperation booking of the belts, frequent changes, that led to the belts meaning nothing, which led to fans not caring about them, which led to them being useless as far as drawing ratings or pay-per-view buys. Like the Flair storyline, however, it would only get worse as time went on. Coming up short in poorly promoted world title matches week after week was also killing Goldberg's drawing power, and he was the last guy with any left after they'd killed Flair in the mental hospital. The saddest part of this whole scenario was that this hotshotting didn't do a rat's ass worth of good. The show only did a 3.89 rating to Ra's 5.99. Lesson not learned, but then learned. During a 3-month period in the fall of 2011, WWE did a similar antic as they changed the WWE title no less than 7 times. This led to no real changes in ratings or pay-per-view buys. What did lead to interest, however, was putting the title on CM Punk and having him hold it for 434 days. It established Punk as a legitimate main eventer, and at the time of this writing, he was one of the company's biggest merchandise movers, despite not even being on television or on shows due to his decision to leave. It didn't appear that things could get any worse for the company, but in early May, it happened. The show began a several-week period of preemptions for the NBA playoffs. Normally, whenever one of the two shows was preempted, the other show would gain 20% of their audience for that night. On May 10, the first night of preemption, Raw gained a whopping 50% of WCW's audience to draw an 8.09 rating with 9.2 million viewers, making it the most watched wrestling TV show in the history of the USA Network since the original Royal Rumble. The main event overrun, featuring Rock and Austin and Vince versus Undertaker and Triple H and Shane McMahon, did a 9.17 rating and 10.4 million viewers, another record. Although the war had really been over for some time, this put the exclamation point on it. At this point, it was clear that there was no turning around anytime soon. The entire WCW product, from the matches to the look of the TV to the announcers to the guys on top to the entire promotional philosophy, was old and stale. The only hope for a turnaround was to basically scrap everything and start all over again. Doing so, obviously, would lead to a further decline, and realistically, it would take a long period, perhaps a few years, of reprogramming before new wrestlers would start to catch on. Some decline was inevitable if the company hoped to turn around, but it would have been better to start when the show was in the fours rather than in the twos. Sadly, those in charge at WCW had zero patience. Nobody had a 2-year plan to turn the ship around. They wanted to turn the ship around that week by any means necessary. Past history should have made it clear that hotshotting generally does more harm than good. But, for whatever reason, nobody internally, at least nobody with the power to do anything about it, could see that, despite the fact that evidence in the forms of ratings and buy rates was readily at their disposal. After having put all their banter, all the online accusations, and all the radio show interviews behind them in order to get back together, Dana and Scott Hall separated again. The bad TV was killing business so fast that the Slambury pay-per-view at the massive TWA Dome, with 3 title matches and a, quote, winner gets control of the company match, resulted in just 13,789 fans paying $494,795. It was a respectable crowd that sadly was generated only by giving away almost 7,000 free tickets. Only 6 months earlier, in the same building, 30,000 fans had paid almost $1 million to get in. When the momentum shifts downward, it does so very quickly. Part of the problem might have been that the previous week's thunder had ended with the following. Slambury! Tomorrow! 8 p.m. Eastern. The problem being, of course, that Thunder aired on Wednesday, and the pay-per-view aired on Sunday. Slambury made no effort to reverse the nonsensical booking trend. Flair beat Piper after hitting him with brass knucks to retain his presidency of the company. After the match, Bischoff, who hadn't had any power in storyline for almost 6 months since his loss to Flair, and had, in fact, last been seen on television working as a janitor, came out and reversed the decision. Long story short, 6 months of storylines were tossed right out the window, with Bischoff's magical and totally incomprehensible return as the babyface company owner. In the main event, Nash beat Paige to win the WCW title. Since this was the fourth time the belt had changed hands in 4 weeks, it would be an understatement to say that nobody cared. The show ended up doing a 0.45 buy rate, putting the company at mid-year 12 million behind budget in pay-per-view alone. Nitro was a comedy of errors the following night. Flair, who had supposedly lost the presidency, was back as president because Bischoff apparently didn't have any power after all. Of course, if that was the case, the Nash title change shouldn't have been allowed to stand either, since Bischoff restarted the match after Paige had won via DQ. Later, however, Gene Okerlund identified Bischoff as, quote, a powerful executive in WCW, though exactly what kind of power he possessed was never specified. Then, Piper gave an interview saying he was president, but later in the speech revealed that he was the commissioner. By the time the show was over, nobody had any idea what in the hell was going on, and that included both fans at home and the people writing the storylines. As the ratings spiral continued, the company decided that fresh blood was in order. Unfortunately, they decided that this fresh blood should be in the form of Tank Abbott, and they signed him to a huge 3-year deal. Abbott, a big fat barroom brawler from Huntington Beach, California, had made his name in the Ultimate Fighting Championship by knocking out a few guys in devastating fashion, and going on to garner the worst record of any professional fighter in the history of that organization. 8 wins, 10 losses. He was charismatic, however, and his occasional knockouts were so vicious that he remained a draw and had some people convinced that he was one of the baddest men on the planet. Keep this in mind throughout the rest of this book, as you see his name pop up here and there. In addition to signing Abbott, they re-signed Dennis Rodman, the same Dennis Rodman who no-showed the final Nitro before his last pay-per-view appearance, showing up at the big show in no condition to perform, did nothing in the match, then sued the company for $550,000. WCW's ingenious plan to settle that suit? Offer him a new contract for 5 more dates. Coincidentally, Rodman's first day was supposed to be the Georgia Dome Nitro on July 5th. And of course, he no-showed. Deciding that they hadn't thrown quite enough money out the window that week, they also signed rapper Master P. Why they decided to sign a rapper who had no interest in getting in the ring and working is anyone's guess. Despite this, he was given $200,000 per appearance. Yes, per appearance. So over the course of a month, WCW paid Master P around $1 million to not wrestle. All of the signings made no difference. On June 7, Raw beat Nitro by over 3.5 points, which was complete and utter destruction. The main angle on the show saw a mysterious white Humvee crash into a limo containing Kevin Nash, seemingly killing him. This was a brilliant idea, considering that he was supposed to headline a pay-per-view 6 days later. Worse, $50,000 was spent to shoot this, and it drew a pitiful 2.7 rating. On commentary, Bischoff hinted that the driver was the WWF's Sable, Rena Mero, who had just filed a $140 million sexual harassment lawsuit against McMahon, and years later she'd go back to work for him and play the angle of his mistress. Welcome to wrestling. Another angle hinted that it was several different people, including Carmen Electra. Yes, that Carmen Electra. In the end, the real driver was never revealed. In a real shocker, Sable actually showed up on Nitro 2 nights later and sat in the front row. The commentators never identified her by name, nor was a graphic put up, and days later, when confronted by WWF lawyers, they actually claimed she had just bought a ticket. Presumably, she also bought front row tickets for all of the security guards surrounding her as well. Later, when questioned about the incident in a USA Today article, she spouted the following gem. I wanted to see if the same level of obscenity was taking place. It was not. WCW after being threatened with a federal lawsuit, told WWF attorney Jerry McDevitt that she hadn't signed anything and would not be shown on their TV again until after her WWF deal expired. To their credit, WCW upheld this agreement. In fact, she never showed up on WCW television again. As if Nitro's ratings freefall wasn't bad enough, WCW Saturday Night had plummeted to a 1.3 rating, its lowest ever. Ever meaning in 3 decades. So, WCW came up with a solution. Put old-timer Dusty Rhodes on commentary. In reality, this might not have been the worst idea because the viewing audience for Saturday Night skewed quite a bit older than for Nitro, and particularly for Raw, whose median viewing age was about 24. The problem was that Dusty was far more interested in putting himself over than the product. Plus, it didn't make any sense for a show viewed by so many middle-aged and older people to be used to debut new talent. The exact opposite held true for Nitro. The average viewer of that show was in their early 30s, yet WCW continually built the show around wrestlers in their 40s and 50s. The following Sunday, WCW presented Great American Bash 1999, an event that so clearly illustrated everything that was killing the company that it could be considered a textbook example for future promoters of what not to do. The show opened with Tony Schiavone, Mike Tenay, and Bobby Heenan running down the card. You might wonder why they would run down the card on the pay-per-view broadcast when fans had already paid for it. The reason, of course, was that they had failed to promote any matches in the weeks leading up to the event. Compare this to, say, McDonald's. You'd never go to the restaurant and wonder what your order was going to consist of. Their commercials run a million times during the day, and in the restaurant itself, you're bombarded with information in the form of giant menus that not only describe in detail what is in each meal, but also feature full-color pictures of the meal in question. If McDonald's only served one item, the McMystery meal, and you never knew whether you were going to get a hamburger, chicken McNuggets, a fish sandwich, or whatever, few would dare to purchase it. WCW pay-per-views were like McMystery meals. You never knew what you were going to get. WCW never bothered to run down their cards on TV, fearing that fans would switch over to Raw while they were doing this. Ironically, they would then complain that nobody was buying their pay-per-views. Lesson not learned. WWE presented a McMystery meal of its own in the form of ECW December to Dismember in 2006. Prior to the event, only 2 matches were promoted, and there was zero real clue as to what else may appear on the show. The event itself was abysmal beyond belief, largely due to infighting behind the scenes between Vince McMahon and Paul Heyman. The show was just a wreck, Heyman noted. I knew it going in. The show was an unmitigated disaster, drawing the lowest domestic buy rate in company history, which led to not only Heyman being fired, but the ECW brand being completely killed off as well. Then the wrestling started, and man, was it ever bad. Hammer versus Mikey Whipwreck. Horrible. Ernest Miller versus Horace Hogan. Atrocious. Ric Flair versus Roddy Piper. Abysmal. Rick Steiner versus Sting. Miserable. And worse, nobody could figure out who won since it just ended when Sting got attacked by 3 dogs. Yes, as in actual canines. Finally, in a horrific match, Nash, not dead after all following the Nitro Humvee attack, beat Randy Savage via DQ when Sid Vicious ran in. Sid, you might recall, had left WCW about 10 years prior on horrible terms after nearly stabbing Arn Anderson to death in a real hotel room brawl in England. We wish we made this stuff up. The show, taking place during the middle of the biggest boom period in American wrestling history, ended up doing a 0.43 buy rate, the 5th lowest up to that point in their history. Nitro the following Monday was at the Superdome in New Orleans before a paying crowd of 15,593. Master P had bragged to the company that his presence would make the building sell out. Considering that the building could hold over 55,000, Master P was wrong. The show was built around him and his crew, the No Limit Soldiers, who repeatedly chanted, "Hooty Hoo!" to progressively louder boos. The idea was that Master P and his crew were supposed to be good guys, taking on the bad guy group of Kurt Hennig and his posse, Barry and Kendall Windham, and Bobby Duncombe Jr., who would become known as the West Texas Rednecks. The problem here was twofold. First, there were 10 or so soldiers and 4 rednecks, which meant the rednecks got cheered for valiantly holding their own against tremendous odds. Second, Hennig and his crew wrote a hilarious country song called "Rap is Crap," and since WCW had its roots in the South, this also got them over as big heroes. "Rap is Crap" became so popular at one point that several country stations around the nation played it in rotation. WCW, of course, responded as they always did when lucking into something like this. They killed the angle dead. Also on the show, Eddie Guerrero returned and had a lackluster match with Juventud Guerrero. Despite having nearly died in a car wreck earlier in the year, his return was presented as an afterthought. Lesson not learned. Much like WCW with "Rap is Crap," WWE failed to capitalize on something handed to them. Actually, the situation is arguably worse. After telling their undercard talent that, quote, no one would hand them anything, and that they had to make their own breaks, one man did just that. Matt Cardona, better known as Long Island Iced Z, Zack Ryder, grabbed a video camera and started a goofy YouTube series known as Z True Long Island Story. In the series, Ryder made fun of himself via a batch of skits with his friends. It started to gain momentum, and to date, has had over 12 million views. That's not a typo. 12 million views! Additionally, Ryder has amassed over 1.3 million followers on Twitter, 600,000 Facebook likes, and was listed as one of Sports Illustrated's 100 most influential social media users in sports. Could anyone blame the guy for having a belt made to declare himself the internet champion? Despite this, and despite nonstop chants for him at event after event, WWE decided to keep him chained to the bottom of the card. When they decided to book him at all, that is. The highlight of the following week's show was actually something really cool that almost nobody picked up on. Flair, Anderson, and Charles Robinson were in the ring. Sid came out for a promo. Arn, who had never been approached when the decision was made to bring Sid back, immediately walked to the corner and just stood there as if he wanted nothing to do with anything that was going on. When the interview was over and they were about to go to commercial, Sid turned, walked over to Arn, and shook his hand. For the week of June 28th, not only did Raw destroy Nitro again, but it set a cable ratings record that will probably never be broken. During the Steve Austin vs. Undertaker main event, where Austin regained the WWF title, the show actually hit a 9.5 rating and 17.1 share. The rating meant 10.7 million people were watching, and the share meant that of all of the TVs with the USA Network turned on in the entire United States, 17% of them were tuned into that match. Overall, it was a 6.64 to 3.41 in favor of Raw. The war was so over at this point that it wasn't even funny. Things were collapsing so quickly that wrestlers were actually going out in public and burying the company. Hogan, who had been off TV for months rehabbing his knee, made a bunch of friends when he appeared on the Man Cow morning show in Tampa that week and ridiculed WCW and all of its wrestlers. He even went as far as to say that he was sick and tired of hearing, quote, Malenko and the rest of the midgets complain about their roles. He also downplayed Goldberg's popularity, saying anyone could win 20,000 matches in a row. Never mind that when Hogan first made it huge in the WWF, He did so by winning approximately 20,000 matches in a row. It was obvious that things weren't going to change for the Mid-Carters, and any of them able to get out of the promotion were doing just that. On June 30, Chris Jericho signed with the WWF. In the 6 months prior to his contract signing, WCW made very little effort to retain him. In the last few weeks, they panicked, but to no avail, as his mind had already been made up for some time. The WWF saw real potential in him, and even went so far as to say he'd be the next Shawn Michaels. Jericho was willing to take a pay cut for an opportunity that he was absolutely not about to get in WCW. Specifically, he had lobbied for a showdown against Goldberg, and despite his having done several interviews setting up the angle, nothing ever transpired. Many of the wrestlers in WCW were upset because Jericho was well-liked, and they couldn't believe the company wouldn't offer him a good deal while it was throwing money away on limos, Humvees, fired NBA stars, and rappers. One of Master P's henchmen, Swole, a huge guy with no talent, was signed for $400,000 per year. As if Jericho couldn't wait to get out of the company fast enough, his fiancé went to the store one day and bought a Jericho Malenko WCW doll set. Strangely, the receipt claimed that she'd purchased a Hogan Sting package. Of course, that meant that Hogan and Sting got the residual revenue from the purchase, not Jericho. "I once received a royalty check in the mail for $0.00, Jericho noted. "Stamps cost 37 cents. What was the sense in even mailing it?" Interestingly enough, before he left, someone asked Jericho if he could also tag along. The conversation went like this. He came flat out and asked me, "Are you going to work for Vince?" "Yeah, I think I'm going to give the WWF a shot." He looked him in the eye and said, "Can you take me with you?" The other party in that conversation? Hulk Hogan. Nitro on July 5 broadcast once again from the Georgia Dome, home to some of its biggest past successes. Those days were long gone. The show drew 25,338 fans, just over half a house, and $594,745. This was especially bad since the costs of running the show were over $1 million. Don't even ask how it was possible to spend $1 million on a Nitro, because nobody will ever figure it out. WCW blamed the low attendance on the holiday weekend. If you haven't already noticed, promoters almost never put the blame for a poor house on themselves. Instead, they blame any outside force they can think of. The crowd is small because it's summer. The crowd is small because it's winter. The crowd is small because it's raining. The crowd is small because it's sunny. By refusing to address the real issue, nobody gives a shit about their show, promoters often delude themselves right out of business. The show was built around two things, the return of Bret Hart and the return of Goldberg. WCW, in its infinite wisdom, advertised neither ahead of time. They did, for some inexplicable reason, find it fit to advertise an Ernest Miller versus Jerry Flynn kickboxing match that nobody outside Flynn and Miller's immediate families could possibly care about. The show also featured another ingenious angle that further killed off one of their belts, the U.S. title. The champion was Scott Steiner, who had recently undergone a complete transformation to become a 1999 version of 1970s icon superstar Billy Graham. In real life, he had an injured back that required surgery. Instead of admitting this on TV and starting a tournament with all of the top guys to crown a new champ, they instead had Ric Flair come out and say that Steiner was so busy pleasuring all of his women that he didn't have time to defend the belt. If that wasn't bad enough, he then awarded the belt to his son, David. The irony of this is that word had gotten out that Ernest Miller was going to be the next U.S. champion, and hardcore fans complained long and loud about how that would tarnish the belt. The show ended in a typical city-killing Georgia Dome fashion, a 1 minute and 27-second main event that ended with 100 guys running in. Bret's interview began with him saying that WCW had told him to go ahead and talk for as long as he wanted. He basically said that his family had lived for wrestling their whole lives, and now, tragically, they had also died for it. He said he wasn't sure if he'd ever wrestle again. This was met with a violently negative reaction, and that if he never got a chance to say it to his fans again, thank you. Getting into the ring was obviously a lot harder than he had thought it was going to be, and it was upsetting to him to hear the few hecklers who obviously didn't understand the gravity of what had happened to his family. And that's about it, he concluded. Thank you very much. The Goldberg return was also epic. First, rock group Megadeth came out to play a tune. WCW would soon learn that concerts on wrestling shows are death in the ratings, as the segment garnered a 2.13, Nitro's lowest number in years. The crowd hated the concert with a passion, but when it was over, an explosion went off, and Goldberg emerged from the flames. The crowd went haywire, and WCW responded by immediately cutting to a commercial. It should be noted that just days after the Megadeth rating came in, the lowest in years, don't forget, WCW contacted KISS and asked them to play at the August 23rd Nitro for $500,000. Then in late July, they contacted Chad Brock, an obscure country singer, and asked if he'd play a song on the August 9th Nitro. Next stop, the Bash at the Beach pay-per-view from Fort Lauderdale. Another truly wretched show in a seemingly unending series. The incident with the most far-reaching consequences was a Junkyard Battle Royal featuring Public Enemy, Jerry Flynn, Steve Regal, Horace Hogan, David Taylor, Brian Knobs, Cyclope, and Mikey Whipwreck. Although they spent $100,000 to put on the match, which took place in a real, honest-to-goodness junkyard, WCW did not see fit to advertise the match on Nitro. Therefore, no one bought the show to see it. Furthermore, Damien, Cyclope, and Whipwreck all suffered serious injuries, as the junkyard was a truly dangerous environment. All three men were out of action for months. I suggested shooting the Junkyard Battle Royal the night before to Jimmy Hart, said Whipwreck. This way, everybody could get a spot or two in, and they could edit it together to make sense. Instead, they shot it live. And we all know how that turned out. If you were there live, it was awesome. An arena made out of junked cars, fire, explosions, and helicopters flying overhead with spotlights. Real cool visual. The main event saw Savage and Sid Vicious beat Sting and Nash in a tag match, so Savage won the WCW title. Yes, the belt was on the line in a tag match. It was quite ironic that Savage was given the belt, considering that he'd been involved in a woman-beating storyline the week before that had the brass at Turner outraged. It also had the wrestlers outraged, since in a completely unscripted moment during one of his skits, he had slapped Tori Wilson across the face. She was so shocked by this that she actually began to laugh on live television. Savage's valet, Gorgeous George, who showed up on TV sporting two black eyes, sat in Nash's corner during the pay-per-view match, but then turned on him at the end to help Savage get the win. Nitro the next night, despite being built around Hulk Hogan's return and subsequent title win over Savage, was shockingly good. Of course, that's shockingly good in comparison to the usual WCW fare. Hogan, because he'd been gone for so long, got a big babyface reaction coming out. And the fact that the main event ended with a babyface winning the belt instead of 100 guys running in for a DQ made the people very happy. Afterwards, Nash came out and challenged Hogan to a title match at their annual Road Wild pay-per-view debacle. A few days after his title win, Hogan was on WCW's internet radio show, WCW Live. Now that he was back and champion again, he did a complete 180 from his Man Cow interview the previous month, this time putting over guys left and right. Goldberg, for example, was now, quote, a big star and a dynamic personality. He also claimed you'd never see him in the red and yellow outfit again. In mid-July, the booking regime changed again. Head Booker Nash was relegated to a minor role behind Bischoff, Hogan, and Dusty Rhodes. They actually put together a very good show on July 19th, but you'd never know that from looking at the ratings. Raw destroyed them again, 6.28 to 3.33. And the Hogan vs. Sid main event did a depressing 2.91. At this point, WCW's best bet would have been to just accept that the war was over and spend some time trying to rebuild the company. And that's exactly what did not happen. First, they had Sting beat Flair for the 1,404,437th time in their WCW career to, quote, win control of the company. Bischoff's storyline was for Sting to give the company back to him, and then he would turn heel and run wild again. Of course, this had been done to death for years, but when you're writing your own TV, you can do whatever you want. There were three ref bumps in this match alone, which made the grand total over the previous 2 weeks about 15. Seriously. The main event also had no finish as Kevin Nash ran in. If you think reading about this feels repetitive, imagine having to watch it week after week after week after week. And then, think about how the folks in charge had no clue as to why ratings were plummeting. The finish was also quite ironic, given that Hogan told the WCW Live radio program a few days earlier that one of the major problems in the company was that the main events never had a finish. The July 26th Nitro from Memphis was not good. Yes, huge shock. It featured Goldberg's first match back against Kurt Hennig, and in one of the most embarrassing moments of the year for the company, the quarter-hour rating was doubled by Raw, which was featuring a mid-card tag bout with Godfather and Val Venus versus Draws and Albert. The show also featured the famed second greatest squash match in the history of wrestling, Chris Benoit versus David Flair. A squash match is an encounter where one wrestler just totally destroys the other. The reason this worked so well is that nobody in the world at the time could dish out a more believable beating than Benoit, and nobody in the world looked like they deserved such a beating more than young David. Benoit gave him a chop to the chest so hard that you actually heard people in the stands scream in terror. Charles Robinson then refused to award the match to Benoit after David gave up. Dallas Page ran in and clocked Benoit with a belt to allow David to get the pin. Perhaps you were wondering why Robinson was allowed to be heel ref when Sting had won the WCW presidency from Ric Flair. Join the club! Leading up to Road Wild, Dennis Rodman finally began to make appearances on WCW telecasts. On the bright side, he showed up every week. The bad news was that his mainstream appeal had vanished. His appearances meant nothing for the ratings, nothing for publicity, and nothing for the matches and angles he was involved in. On top of this, he made claims in public that for the five dates, he was making $1 million, which was probably legitimate, as Master P was being paid this amount, and he had nowhere near the same name recognition as Dennis Rodman. Meanwhile, Chris Jericho, who had always been told that he was too small, couldn't sell tickets, and wasn't a ratings draw, debuted on the August 9th Raw in a confrontation with The Rock and helped garner a 6.53 rating to Nitro's 2.37. What is ironic about this is that the Nitro segment he destroyed featured Dallas Page, who on his website a few weeks earlier had stated that Jericho had never drawn a buy rate and wasn't a main event caliber wrestler. Also on Nitro, Chad Brock appeared for his big concert, with the good news being that even though the rating tanked, it only tanked to a 2.35. The WCW storyline that most mirrored real life, who the hell runs this company, continued on August 9th when Sting returned control of WCW back to WCW. Because that plotline hadn't been beaten into the ground already. More specifically, Dusty Rhodes was chosen in storyline to share the duties with J.J. Dillon, who, for whatever reason, had always seemed to have some power anyway. They also continued killing off potential stars, as Hennig, who was really starting to get over with the Rap Is Crap tune, was given brand new, horrible music. In another lame effort to sell pay-per-view buys, The Hogan vs. Nash world title match at Road Wild was changed to a loser-must-retire match. And so Road Wild came, and as you can probably guess, it was atrocious. But little did anyone watching know just how unraveled things had become behind the scenes in the days prior to the event. The event was preceded by the annual motorcycle ride to Sturgis,